topic this year is a sensitive one. You'll notice the course is called Moral Dilemmas in the Parsha. Now, when we talk about moral dilemmas in the Parsha, I think we're going to see there's some very, very different approaches, and we're going to have to try together to find the middle ground, perhaps, so to say. So what I really wanted to do this week is give a little bit of an introduction, and then perhaps when we get into Vayikra, over there maybe we'll talk about what is morality, how is morality defined, because I don't want to give up on the stories in Bereishit that really are the ones that raise that issue. So now, if we begin with source number one, which is a very famous pasuk in Yeshayahu, where Yeshayahu says like this, Shimu Eli rotei tzedek mevakshei Hashem. Those of you who want to find tzedek, those of you who are searching out God, Hebitu el tzur chutzavtam ve'el makvat bor nikartem. Look to the rock from which you were hewn, and from the hole of the pit from which you were dug. In other words, if you want to find out, you want to find God, how do you find God? Find God by going back and looking at your ancestors. And in case you didn't understand Pasuk Aleph, Pasuk Bet tells you very clearly, Hebitu el Avraham Avichem. Are you surprised to find that in Yeshayahu? Okay, Yeshayahu says, go back and look at Avraham. The El Sarah Tekol El Chem. Not only Avraham, but Yeshayahu also mentions, go back and look at Sarah. Equally, Avraham and Sarah. And that is where you are from. Ki echad kativ ve'arvachehu ve'arbehu. Because I chose him alone and I blessed him and increased him. So we already understand that we have an intense obligation to research the Avot for the purpose of finding out how to get to God and how to find Mishpat. Now, basically, there are actually, I think, two major issues that we are going to be discussing when we discuss the morality of the Avot. One is A, how do we look at the Avot? And B, this is very much directly connected to how do we view Pshat. How do we look at what is actually written in those psukim? And does anybody understand why these two ideas are inherently connected? And I think that before we even begin, we need to decide that here we are not going to act as judges, and we are not going to look at the psukim, but we're going to look at it as explorers, as questioners, and try to find out. Now, if we want to take the two most extreme views, okay, extreme view number one is what belongs to the Bible critics and people who do not have a religious connection to the text. And how do they view the Avot? As human beings. Not only as human beings, but as flawed human beings, correct. Okay, and that is the extreme on one side. The extreme on the other side would be that not only we're not talking about flawed human beings, but rather we're talking about saints. What? Now, see, there's a difference between tzaddikim and saints. This is an important distinction. In order in Christianity, in order to become a saint, by definition, that means that not only did you have to do a miracle, it means you have not ever sinned. So that, and a tzaddik, we said you can sin, but you are still a tzaddik. Okay, so that. Again, so we're talking about the two different approaches to how do we view the Avot. Is one that they are flawed human beings with nothing, doesn't make them special at all. And the second approach is that they are actually angels. Let's use that term. And therefore, as angels, they are almost, they are untouchable. And therefore, we cannot take this approach. And we are going to see that within the commentaries, we are going to find allusions to both of these approaches. Now, before we even go any further, I'd like to just take a step back for a minute and talk about how do we view sin in general, sin of biblical personalities in general. Now, first of all, we always need to remember that if we're learning one specific story, that specific story is part of a much larger picture. And Chazal assumed that when you were studying Torah, you had knowledgeable, you knew all of the stories, all 24 books. Okay, and they assumed that you had this working knowledge of all the books, so that you weren't necessarily looking at just one story, but you were always looking at it in the whole context. So that's something we always need to keep in the back of our minds, that we are looking at a very small slice of a much larger cake. The next thing we need to take into consideration is we need to remember, what does the word Torah mean? To teach, to instruct. And we need to remember Torah was written not as a history book, but Torah was written as an educational instrument. And that we have this idea that Ein Tzadik Ba'aretz Asher Yaseh Tov V'lo Yechteh. There is no, by definition, the term human being means that you are susceptible to sin. And therefore, but that is not necessarily the downfall of man. And that doesn't make you necessarily a negative personality. That is just part of your makeup as a human being. Now, as part of this, we also need to remember that the Chazal say that the greater somebody is, the greater first of all, the greater they can fall, the taller you are, the harder you can fall. That is true as well, which I think is an important point. And there's also the idea of the greater you are, the larger your Yetzirah is. That God makes it balanced, because otherwise it would be too easy. Okay? And there's this idea that great people also have an evil inclination, and they are people as well. So we have to keep that in mind. So we're keeping the whole picture in mind. We're keeping that greater people do have Yetzirah. We also have the idea that Torah is written as an educational book. Now, when we get up on Yom Kippur and we say as a kahal, ashamnu, bagadnu, gazanu. Let's take that example. Now, there are different types of stealing. Normally you say, what's gazanu? Is you take something that does not belong to you. But you know as well as I do that you can probably all have think of other subtle forms that could be considered stealing, like cheating, right? That would be an example for students in school. Or at work, taking a paperclip, perhaps that doesn't belong.
Talking
on the phone when you're supposed to be working. And the story goes that Rev Cook told a story about himself. He says, when I clap a shamnu, he says, what do I think about? That when the telephone rang and I didn't answer it fast enough, I was stealing from the person on the other end of the phone.
No, we're
not there. We're not there. I understand. I understand that most of us.
They're stealing my time.
Yes.
Right, they call him. They were stealing his time.
They're stealing my time.
Right. But you understand what I'm trying to show you here is that when we use the term steal, it has a very, very wide and broad connotation depending on who you are and where you are in life. Okay, so that when we're talking about the written word, if I say to you, my son speaks well. Now, how are you going to understand that sentence?
Hmm.
Depends how old.
First of all, you want to know how old he is. If he's two, then you're going to see that he's able to put together three words in a sentence. If he's 22, you're going to understand that perhaps he's very eloquent. Okay, so you understand that the same sentence, the same word, depending on who it's talking about, the whole context, where that sentence appears, can be understood in many different ways. So when we talk about the avot in the mikra, we need to remember that here too, there are many different layers and many different ways of understanding this as well. Now, some people do take this approach, by the way, and take it a little bit extreme. Like if you look at source number three, source number three is basically saying that you can't really judge the avot. And so that our whole semester is basically finished before we've even started. Source number three says like this, Amar Rav Zera, Amar Rabba Bar Zimurna, Im Rishonim Bnei Melachim, Anu Bnei Anashim. If the forefathers were angels, then we are people. Ve'im rishonim bnei anashim. But if you want to look at the forefathers as being human beings, what does that make us?
Donkeys.
Chamorim. That makes us donkeys. You understand? It all becomes relative. If they're angels, then we're humans. If you want to look at them as humans, that leaves us as basically donkeys. Okay, and by the way, you should know, not like special donkeys. We're talking about the guys you see on the street. In other words, this... So that's what I say. If you take this approach, you're basically saying, it's not even so much to say that they don't have Yetzer Hara. This approach is basically saying that, who are you to judge them? How are you even comparing yourself to that generation? However you want to look at them, even if you look at them as human beings rather than angels, you're still, well, compared to them, you are a nobody. So that becomes a question that we need to keep in the back of our mind when we talk about sins, and we talk about the whole picture, we talk about the different layers. At a certain point, you have to say, wait a minute, what even gives you the right to judge them? Now, there is an important approach here, which I think is important to mention. The fact that Torah does discuss the sins of the forefathers gives the Torah a certain amount of authenticity. How and what way does it give it authenticity? By the fact that if we wanted to draw out our forefathers as saints, and that was our whole being, then we would just leave out all of those stories. Why do we need to include those stories? But when we understand that the purpose of Torah is not only as a history book, but it is to educate, and therefore we understand that that actually tells us that there's more here to it. Now, there is another opinion, by the way, floating around, you'll say, that goes back to this idea, how can we judge them? Some people say, well, human nature has changed. Right? Human nature has changed. Society has changed. Technology has changed. So why can't we say that human nature has changed? Rav Aaron Lichtenstein comes out very against this opinion. Why?
It hasn't changed.
Because it hasn't changed. Things have changed. But also he would say, let me just finish this point. Why do you think he says human beings haven't changed? That's what he says. If human beings changed, then why do we even study Torah? He says it would negate the whole idea of generations and learning from back and look back to Abraham, where you came from. So if Lichtenstein completely rejects this idea.
I would think that there would be another option.
We're going to come to that. I said we started with the extremes, we're going to come to the middle road in a minute. Let's take a look now at how Chazal take a look at this opinion. Now, many of you are familiar with the Gemara in source number 2. The Gemara in source number two, I say, is very well known. It's the Gemara that appears in Masechet Shabbat on page 55. And I brought you just the beginning of the sentences. The beginning of the sentence is like this, says, Amar Reb Shmuel Bar Nachmani, Amar Reb Yochanan. Kol ha'omer ru'u ben chata, eina ela toeh. Whoever says that Reuven sinned when he moved the bed, he's wrong. Next sentence. Again, same person. Kol ha'omer b'nei Shmuel chat'u eino elatar. Whoever says that b'nei Shmuel sinned when they were, it says that they were sleeping with the women at the Mishkan, wrong. Kol ha'omer David chat'a. Whoever says that David sinned, eino elatar. He too is wrong. Kol ha'omer Shlomo chat'a. Whoever wants to say that Shlomo sinned, he too is wrong. Kol ha'omer Yoshiyahu chata eino elata. So in other words, and then of course the sentences that you're missing is how the Gemara justifies the actions of those people. But you would say based on this Gemara, what essentially is the approach of Chazal? At least certainly in this, or certainly the approach of Shmuel Bar Nachmani.
Them saints are not human.
He doesn't necessarily say that they were saints. That he's not saying.
He says there's no free will.
He doesn't say that there's no free will. That's not what he's saying either. But he's saying that when you read a verse that says, David says to Natan HaNavi, Chatati, I have sinned, Rabbi Shmuel Bar Nachmani is saying you are not understanding that story correctly. That is the point that he's making. So he is really taking, I don't think he's going to that extreme, he's not saying that they didn't sin, but he's saying that we need to reevaluate that sin and understand it in the context of the whole picture, understand the picture of the nuances of the language.
Isn't he saying it wasn't a sin?
So isn't he saying, eino ela toeh, he's making a mistake. So it seems to be that we're not questioning their behavior, we're questioning our understanding of their behavior.
Are they on the same
level as the avot? So that's a very good question. Are we? Can we separate the avot from the other personalities as well? And I think that we are going to have to look at our leaders as a group. But there is going to be a difference between before Torah and after Torah as well, which we will definitely see. Now, I think that many of us also have been learning Tanakh for many years. Many of us started learning Tanakh when we were in elementary school, gone. And therefore, we almost are at a disadvantage. In what way does it make us disadvantaged?
The way you learned it when you were three. That's the story of six.
That's right. That's what sticks in your head. And many of us are coming into these stories with preconceived notions. And at a certain point, we really do need to ask ourselves, and that's the idea here, is are humans, are they angels? Do I have anything to learn from them? Do we look at them? How are we supposed to? And then the question is, how do we teach it to our children? How do we understand it personally? And it becomes a question down further. Now, if you look at source number four is with Aaron Cutler, who is the Rosh Yeshiva in Lakewood. And he comes out very strongly like this. When one teaches students a section dealing with the actions of the patriarchs, one must explain to them that we are not speaking about regular human beings who have character traits and desires. Rather, we are discussing individuals of whom we cannot in any way understand their level, people devoid of all human desire, eternal will, and just as we have no criteria by which to evaluate angels, so we have no way of evaluating and appreciating the levels of the forefathers. Okay? This is a very clear, educational, even maybe halachic decision that is coming out from one of the major personalities in American Haredi Judaism. And he is taking that approach that we called before the extreme on one end. And notice he'll say all of those are these things we said. They are not human beings. They do not have desires. There is no way to understand them. We have no ability to evaluate them. Now, let's try to take a step up. I'm seeing it from the nodding of your heads. Most of you are uncomfortable with this approach. Okay, and by the way, one of the things that we are going to say, this is one of the distinctions between what we would say the Haredi approach versus the perhaps the more modern approach. But let's take a step back and see if we can understand what is motivating Rev Cutler to say this. What do you think is, like, his motivation? You can't even...
because they were some of the things that they did were so unacceptable to us that how can we accept that? So if they were really beyond, then we can accept it. That if they weren't really human or they were had other...
I think, if I'm understanding you correctly, what you're trying to say is it's sort of educating for this blind faith approach. That, well, it is what it is. You know, and don't even try to go there.
There were many levels.
Don't try to understand it. Now, but what's the advantage of teaching that way?
No questions.
Yes, right. Okay. But understand like this. I think if you follow it through, it's like this. If the Avot can make mistakes, if David and Shlomo can make mistakes, then Chazal can make mistakes. Then the rabbis can make mistakes, right? And that is not acceptable. So in order to prevent that sort of slippery stone idea of starting from the fault of the Avot, this way we say the holies can never sin, and therefore that maintains their authority all the way down. Now, it happens to be, perhaps let's try to also give some benefit of the doubt to this opinion. Remember, we are living in a generation where irreverence is the accepted mode of behavior. And we are very quick to judge, and we're very skeptical. So it could be that he's sort of reacting to... You know, sometimes you need to go to the other extreme in order to come up with that middle type of idea. Or he could also be reacting to the biblical critics. Remember, till 1800, you know, everybody accepted Tanakh for what it was. And so perhaps in order to, like, defend Torah from the biblical critics, he is going to an extreme in order to defend what he views as defense of Torah.
Believe it.
I believe that Rav Cutler believes that, yes.
Okay.
I believe that he believes, and I believe that this is the philosophy that's being taught in their schools that buy into this philosophy. Okay? And that's why it was important for me, I needed you to see it, I need you to know it, and by the way, it's not only Rav Cutler who believes in this, it's also Rav Nevensal buys into this, if you read his books. He very much buys into this. Rev Aviner, in some of his books, hints at this. Have you heard the expression Tanakh Begova Einayim?
Yes.
Did she mention it last class? Okay, because the Tanakh Begova Einayim very much touches on this question as well. It's that connection of how do we view Tanakh, how do we view Pshat, what is our preconceived notion that we're coming into Tanakh on. Okay, now it is also this idea, by the way, life, and many of us know, you know, at a certain age you realize, life is not black and white. But it's very hard to educate to gray. So therefore, many schools will take the black and the white approach, and that is what they teach, and therefore we get stuck into that. Now, I think it's important to understand for a minute, let's talk about that. Why doesn't Torah portray black and white? Why does Torah, and you see that, Mrs., that we're going to study the same story, and we're going to see two different sides of the same coin. David says he sinned, Chazal say, whoever says, made a mistake. Why does Torah specifically go towards this gray area? Because they like gray?
Because
life is gray, that's what I'm saying. Life is gray? What?
Everything has a right answer and a wrong answer.
Life doesn't work that way. And also, I think many of you have had this experience that you understand a story a certain way when you're a teenager. When you become a parent, you understand the story completely differently. When you become a grandparent, all of a sudden, that story has a new... And at different stages in your life, you understand and relate to the stories in a different way. So therefore, stories are a very important tool because it allows for the reflection of real life, and it allows the reflection of human beings in order to identify with the stories at different points in time. The other thing, which is something that I think we all know, are people, humans, are complex. She's laughing. To say the least. Right? Life is complicated. Family dynamics are complicated. And again, at different stages in life, we understand that at different levels. So we have Miriam, we have Aaron, we have, they are, the relationship they have to Moshe. All of that reflects a family dynamic which is complicated. And finally, we need to think there's the flip side of that also, which is also something that gets hidden sometimes in the text. Our evil characters in the Bible are not necessarily all that evil. Right? You think Esav is like the paradigm of the bad guy. But if you read the text as the text, he's not such a bad guy. Right? There's a tremendous amount of things there as well. So, and even Paro, who is the, you know, the one who enslaved, you know, the Jews and is viewed as, you know, the Hitler of his time, has a daughter who is a moral heroine. That doesn't come out of a vacuum. Okay, so we understand that there is a certain amount of complexity here that we need to really think about as well. And lastly, and more importantly, the purpose of Torah, and almost, I think, any religious literature, is to make a distinction between God and humans. God is God, and there is space for humans to strive to be like God, but humans can never be God. And therefore, we are looking at, mistakes sometimes made by the Avot. Now, so we understand the approach. We understand the far extreme approach. Let's look at a perfect example here in the Ramban. If you look at source number, well, let's start first with the Rambam in source 10. The Rambam in Moreh Nevuchim says like this: when we have acquired a true knowledge of God and rejoice in that knowledge in such a manner that while speaking to others and attending to our bodily wants, our mind is all that time with God. When we are with our heart constantly near God, even while our body is in the society of men, then we have attained not only a height of ordinary prophets, but of Moshe, our teacher. The patriarchs likewise attained this degree of perfection. Their mind was so identified with the knowledge of God that he made a lasting covenant with each of them. When we therefore find them also engaging in ruling others, in increasing their property, In endeavoring to obtain possessions of wealth and honor, we see in this fact a proof that they were occupied in these things. Only their bodily limbs were at work, while their heart and mind never moved away from the name of God. This is a new approach. It's not all the way to the right, or to the extreme on one side, it's not to the extreme on the other side. What is this middle-of-the-road approach that Rambam, Maimonides, is presenting here? It seems like he's almost playing both sides of the field. Why? On one hand, he's saying the avot were involved in every day. They had to go to work, they had to pay taxes, they had to go to war, they had to increase their property, they had to perhaps even obtain wealth and honor, which we would view as being very materialistic, very mundane, very unholy types of acts. But the Rambam says, don't think that when they were doing that, they were only involved in that for its own sake. They were involved in it. Their hearts and minds were always connected to God. So that's why I say I think this is sort of a middle-of-the-road approach. He has them doing both, playing both sides at the same time. Now, the Ramban has a fascinating approach. Let's look at source 7. Now, source 7, the Ramban is describing, after God tells Avraham to come to Eretz Yisrael, he is there, and all of a sudden there's a famine. Avraham leaves to go to Egypt. Know that Avraham Avinu inadvertently committed a great transgression by placing his righteous wife in a stumbling block of sin because of his fear lest they kill him. He should have relied on the Almighty that he would save him and his wife and all of his possessions. Also, his departure from the land that he was commanded upon on the outset because of a famine was a sin he committed. For the Almighty in famine would redeem him from death. What is the Ramban doing here? The Ramban very clearly, there's no doubt here, says that Avraham sinned. Now, the Haredi world tends to say that they are the ones who are continuing the Mesorah, and that's the way that it's always been. But as soon as you look at the Ramban, who is considered, one of the greatest commentators, you see that in actuality, their approach is the new approach. And they are actually leaving what medieval commentators viewed as important.
What's the meaning of their approach? Their approach?
The saying that the avot didn't sin,
right?
That's new.
That's new.
That's new. That's, 20th century. 13th century, 14th century, the Ramban has, now he doesn't say they were human beings.
A long time before that.
The Ramban says very clearly, I don't think there's any other way to understand the sentence. He inadvertently committed a great transgression. And two sins. One sin is that he placed Sarah in danger. And second sin is that God had told him to come to the land. God never told him to leave. How did he leave? Now, look at the last sentence where we left off. Because of this incident, the decree of Galut in the land of Egypt, the hands of power, was imposed on his seed. The place of judgment is the place of transgression and wrong. Now this already moves us into a different level, that the avot were humans, they did actions, but their actions have, whether they're good or bad, their actions have consequences for the future. Now that moves them out of the ordinary human being and moves them into a level of role models, which not only do we look at in terms of where we came from, but they are role models who influence how the future is going to happen. Look at source number 8. Source number 8, again, is the Ramban, where here he's talking about Sarah, when it says that Sarah, persecuted, the word in Hebrew, Hagar. Our mother sinned with this act of affliction. So Sarah sinned. And also Avraham sinned by permitting her to do this. God heard Hagar's affliction and gave her a son that would be a Perah Adam to afflict the seeds of Avram and Sarah with all, source 8, beginning of page 3, with all sorts of affliction. Again. Pardon?
God told Abraham to listen to Sarah.
That was to kick out Ishmael. That's a little later. We're going to actually talk about this next week. We're going to get this idea. And finally, you have this in source number 9 as well. Now, source number 9 is fascinating. Source number 9 is talking already about Eliezer. Eliezer gets to Aram Naharayim, and it says that the first thing he does is he takes off the muzzles. And Ramban says in source number 9, don't understand that he unfastened the muzzles, that he unfastened their neck bridles, because the custom was to lead them harnessed. Now Rashi there says he loosened their muzzles for they would shut their mouths so they would not graze along the way of the fields belonging to others. Rashi says that the camels were Avram muzzled his camels so they wouldn't steal the grass of others. The Ramban is asking on Rashi. And in the words of the Bereishit Rabbah, he loosened their muzzles. Rav Huna and Rav Yirmiyahu asked Rav Chiya, the son of Rav Abba, were not Avraham Avinu's camels compared to Pinchas ben Yair's donkey? And that question refutes that their muzzles were unfastened. Okay, now listen, let me give you a little background. Pinchas ben Yair had a donkey. And you saw we mentioned it earlier, like you shouldn't think that you're like that donkey. His donkey didn't need to be muzzled because his donkey would never eat from the fields of others. His donkey would never work on Shabbat. You know, his donkey was a direct reflection of the moral status of his owner. So the Ramban is saying, wait a minute, you want me to think that his donkey was able to go unmuzzled because it reflects the moral place of the owner, but Avram Avinu's donkeys had to be muzzled? Can't be. So on one hand, in source 7 and 8, the Ramban has no problem coming along and saying Avram sinned. But here in source 9, the Ramban is coming along and saying, but you cannot expect me to believe Rashi, who says that they were muzzled. It has to be that he opened the neck bridles, because it is not possible that the chassidut, the piety, in Rav Pinchas ben Yair's home was greater than Avram Avinu's home. And since Rabbi Pinchas ben Yair's donkey did not need to be kept away from things which were forbidden for his owner to feed him, all the more so Avram Avinu's camels. And there was no need to muzzle them because they shall not be caused to a righteous man any iniquity. So we understand here that the Ramban is actually, like the Rambam, trying to create a middle-of-the-road approach to what seems to be almost conflicting opinions of the Avot. So what the Ramban, his approach is like this. The Avot and Imahot were humans. Sometimes they made mistakes, sometimes they didn't. But every action they did was enveloped with importance, significance, and basically they are, as we saw in Yeshayahu, the expression that he uses, they are the stone from which we were hewn. And therefore we need to look at them as this role model. Now the advantage, and we talked about why Rav Cutler takes the approach that he does. What is the advantage of the Ramban's approach? It makes the stories more believable. And as we said, it gives a certain authenticity to Torah.
Makes it possible for us to learn.
Right. It makes us possible, for it gives us something to strive for. It makes us something for us to say that, well, people are humans, people make mistakes, but that doesn't keep you from becoming an Avram and a Sarah. And so that if we too make mistakes, that doesn't prevent us from becoming Avram and Sarah. Now, this approach became also very well known by Rev Hirsch. I think he even takes it a little further than the Ramban, which you have in source 11. And he says very clearly. Now, remember, Rev Hirsch is living at the time of the beginning of the biblical critics in Germany. The Torah never hides from us the faults, the errors, and the weakness of our great men, which means that we have to understand it as it's written. Just by that, it gives the stamp of veracity to what it relates, right? It proves that it's true. But in truth, it is given us by their faults and weaknesses. Our great men are in no way made lesser, but actually greater and more instructive. If they stood before us as the purest models of perfection, we should attribute them as having a different nature, which was denied us. Were they without passion, without internal struggles, their virtues would seem to us the outcome of some higher nature, hardly a merit, and certainly no model that we could hope to emulate. Our sages, who never objected to drawing attention to the small and the great mistakes and weaknesses in the history of our great forefathers, and thereby reflect the greatness of the Torah, and upheld its lessons for all generations. Rev Cutler is afraid that if we present the Avot as negative, doing negative actions, we are some way taking away from their greatness. And Rev Hirsch is saying just the opposite. It's because they had faults. It's because they had desires, because they had passion. If Avram Avinu didn't have any feelings, then the Akedah would be meaningless. Wouldn't mean anything. It's only if he has passions, it's only if he has desires, then it means anything. We follow the opinion of our sages and do not consider it our task to be apologists for our great men and women, saying, well, it's not really a sin. Just as the word of God, the Torah itself, never refrains from informing us of their errors and weaknesses. So you see, I think Rav Hirsch is taking perhaps what we would call the more modern approach, where he is saying that our forefathers are humans who make mistakes, and it is through their mistakes that we are able to learn their greatness. It is... Say it again.
They also are able to learn. Our forefathers are also able to learn.
They too go through a growth process. Correct. They too are somebody that goes through a learning process as well, and in that way they become role models.
Someone like Rav Cutler, who holds this tradition and this opinion that there can be no wrong in those who came before, how does he hold something that came from the Rambam that said they sinned? Like, did you just take that whole, everything that's written up there and put it aside and say, that's also wrong? Because then you saying that they were, you're picking and choosing who was really Chazal, who was a great rabbi, who wasn't, because if you know that, your opinions that aren't yours.
Right. So the approach they would say is, well, we're not really understanding that Ramban properly.
Okay.
Just the way we're not understanding the Avot properly.
As we understand, not understanding that they said
right. Acid. Right. That's correct. That's the language game as well.
Bring up again that they can take that approach to defend the Holy Being. That's how you.
I'm not trying to be critical.
It's not. This is just. It's just. It's just trying to an approach.
How does the person do that?
Wait a second. But the second source says that everybody who says that this person is in
right.
Wrong.
It comes from. It doesn't. It's not coming from a vacuum. There is a tradition for that as well. There is a tradition that's coming. It's coming. And that's what I'm trying. And
that's what I'm trying to say.
We're seeing here, and I said we're going to find commentaries who say both those approaches, and that we are going to have to tread a very fine line here when we talk about these stories between these two avot. I want you to go back now to source number five, to Rev Lichtenstein. Rev Lichtenstein, in an article called Torah and General Culture, Jewish Encounter with Other Cultures. Now, you know, those of you who know Rev Lichtenstein already know what he's going to say, but he says like this: advocates of hagiographic parshanut. Hagiographic means turning people into saints. Turning, you know, turning them divine, making people divine, which portrays the central heroic figures of scriptural history as virtually devoid of emotion, can only regard the sharpening of psychological awareness within the reference to Tanakh with a jaundiced eye. For those of us who have been steeped in Midrashim, as you pointed out, the Ramban, the Emek Davar, in a tradition that is, which regards our patriarchal avot and their successors as very great people indeed, but as people nonetheless, and which, moreover, sees their greatness as related to their humanity, enhanced literary sensitivity can be viewed as a significant boon. Okay? So we do have this idea. We saw the idea that says they're angels. We see this idea that we see they are people. And I think what the approach that we're going to have to stick with over the course of the idea is that they are humans who are struggling for perfection. And that they have certain obstacles on the way, and they also have to learn to overcome those obstacles. It wasn't a smooth path for them as well. And just the way that they have overcome the obstacles, it allows us, and it makes it almost easier for us because they have already done it once before.
Don't you think also what made the Avot so great is that they have this relationship with God, and it sometimes is up and sometimes it's down, just like that we can identify with.
Right, and I think that becomes one of the key issues, is this idea of being able to identify. And that brings us to our last source. I was very, very pleased to find a translation. But the Netziv, who is the Emek Davar, who, Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin, in his introduction to Sefer Bereishit, it's at the bottom of page 4. Remember, the real question is, if Torah is just supposed to be a compilation of laws, keep Shabbos, give Masa, whatever it is, why do we have all of these stories in Bereishit? So the Netziv says, Rabbi Yochanan explains that this is the book that deals with the lives of Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, who are called upright. Yisharim is the Hebrew term. As we see that Bilam said, Tamut nafshi mavet yisharim, let my soul die the death of the upright. We shall try to understand, now this we said this before, why does Bilam call our forefathers specifically upright ones and not tzaddikim or not chassidim? Why does he specifically use the term yisharim? Moreover, we shall analyze the question of why Bilam prayed for himself, wishing that his end should be like the upright ones, and why this volume was given an added name of Sefer Yisharim. You know, every book has a second name. Vayikra is called Torat Kohanim. Devarim is called Mishneh Torah. Bereishit is not only called Bereishit, but it's also called Sefer HaYashar. So, it's Sefer HaYashar because in the Sefer are these Yisharim. So the Netziv is going to explain to us why. All these questions, the beginning of page 5, all these questions can be answered and explained by elucidating upon the phrase in the Song of Ha'azinu, the rock, his work is perfect. Tzur tamim pa'alo, ki chol derachav mishpat v'tzedek, he is righteous and upright. The word upright shows the justness of the judgment of his destruction of Jerusalem and the second temple during the time of a generation whose outlook was crooked and twisted. Let's understand. Listen carefully. It is explained that the people of the generation of the Second Temple were righteous, pious, intensely involved in Torah study. Second Temple, we view them as, you know, terrible people, temples destroyed. The Netziv is telling you no. The people were learning Torah. They were tzaddikim. They were chassidim. They were fasting every Monday and Thursday. However, they were not upright in their relationship with others, either in their actions, thoughts, or speech. Therefore, right, we all say that Second Temple was destroyed because of Sinat Chinam. And here the Netziv is explaining that Sinat Chinam, their relationship to man was bad, but their relationship to man to God was excellent. Therefore, because of the unwarranted hatred each had for the other, one would falsely accuse another of heresy, simply because the other's religious expression and way of respecting and showing reverence to God was not in accordance with his own way. He served God differently, so right away I called him Apikoros, Goy, whatever it is you called him. The one whose way was different was therefore labeled a non-believer and considered cut off from authentic Judaism, even though the person fulfilled the Torah commandments. You think differently than I? Out. This lack of tolerance and limited acceptance of individual religious expression eventually led to murder in the first degree and to all the evils in the world. Eventually, God felt that punishment, the destruction of the Holy Temple, was necessary. From this punishment, we can see the righteousness of the divine judgment. For the Holy One, the Almighty, is upright and will not tolerate so-called religious people such as these. However, the ruler will sanction them only with the stipulation that they choose the upright way in their relationship with others. God does not want people to be devious, even if their acts are proclaimed for the sake of heaven, since the essence of these acts is corrupt. This perverted manner destroys creation and uproots the tranquil settlement of the earth. And now, we understand the reason for the unique praise attributed to our patriarchs and matriarchs. Not only were they righteous and pious, and not only did they love God in their fullest abilities, but in addition, they were upright. They were yashar. This is to say, they accustomed themselves to deal straightforwardly with other people, not only because it is honest to do so, but also because they realize that this positive way of relating to people bestows the continuity of existence of creation. Even idol worshippers, despite their low and despicable spiritual level, were treated with love and concern for their well-being by our patriarchs and matriarchs. This is exemplified to the great extent to which Avraham, our father, applied himself through intensive prayers and appeals to gain the preservation of wicked Sodom. Avram beseeches God to spare Sodom, even though he hated the people and their leaders to the fullest degree because of their wickedness that saturated their very being. Nevertheless, he wanted them to continue to exist. In the Medrash, this concept of Avram's compassion is touched upon when we learn that the Almighty said to Avram, our father, "You love righteousness and hate evil. Namely, you love to find the good within all my creatures, to make them right before me, and you hate to attribute evil to them to make them guilty." Thus, Avram was truly worthy of being called by God the father of a multiple of nations, Av Hamon Goyim. For just as when a son does not follow a straight path, yet his father nevertheless desires his welfare and goodness, giving him what is best and most beneficial, so Avraham extended his loving kindness to give continuity to the world. Another clear example of Avraham's worthiness is exemplified in the grace that was poured forth by Avraham in his unique extension of tolerance towards Lot. We also see how compassionate, calm, and serene Yitzchak, our forefather, was when making no demands for himself. He was appeased by his adversaries, Abimelech and his entourage, with a minimum of wars of placation. He was mollified to a greater extent than they had requested. Yaakov, our father, got very angry with Laban, for he knew that Laban wanted to kill him, to destroy him completely, and that Laban would have succeeded in killing him had it not been for God's intervention. Nevertheless, Yaakov spoke gently to Laban and readily formed a peace agreement with him. Thus, our sages say, better is the patriarch's reconciliatory approach of dealing with assertiveness than the humility of later generations. There is truly much to be learned from the peaceful manner in which the patriarchs approached life and accepted others, quality so vitally necessary to sustain the world. This is the principal idea of this book, the Book of Creation. Therefore, it is also called the Book of the Upright, because of so many episodes of the patriarch's deeds which illustrated their true love of humanity and their astounding tolerance. What about Balaam? What was Balaam's rationale for calling the patriarchs the upright ones, and why did he wish to end up as the upright ones? At the moment of his divine inspiration, he did not consider to wonder about his low level of piety, which was in contrast to Avraham Yitzchak and Yaakov's devotion to God. This was natural because Balaam was a prophet of the nations of the world, and since he believed in idols, the essence of his being came from the source of impurity. But Balaam was upset about his bad conduct towards humankind. Thus, it was most natural for him, an idolater, to hate the Israeli nation because they, the Israelites, were the children of Avraham Yitzchak and Yaakov and had their source of being in the foundation of sanctity, which is diametrically opposed to his source of being, impurity. Nevertheless, it was not proper for him to make demands that an entire nation be uprooted. Such an act of destruction would not have been in accordance with the continued existence of the world and would have been the antithesis of humanitarianism. Considering his recognition of the Jewish patriarch's level of tolerance, Balaam cried out, "Let my soul die the death of the upright, and let my end be like his." That is to say, Balaam wanted his end to be like those who sustain creation and help it remain in existence because they are straightforward, upright people. The Book of the Upright, the Book of Creation, the Book of Bereishit are one and the same. The founders of Judaism, from Avraham, Sarah, Yitzchak, Rivka, Yaakov, Rachel, Leah, are all examples to our humanity. Their godly views reflect true tolerance for a real love of humanity, since they desire all of creation to exist. So in other words, first of all, I think the Netziv is so important. And it's as if he wrote it today. Right? It is as if something that we can all, especially unfortunately living here in Israel, it's something that we can all relate to. That anybody whose practice is different, anybody who doesn't look and believe the same way as I do, is automatically categorized as evil, beyond the pale, you know, kick them out, whatever it is. And the Netziv said that kind of, you want to know why the Beit HaMikdash has not been destroyed, has not been rebuilt, is because we haven't necessarily fixed this exact problem. And he says the story, the reason Bereishit is there, is in order for not to teach mitzvot, but to teach almost the prerequisite for mitzvot. To teach that not only do we have to worry about the mitzvot bein adam l'makom, we have to view the bein adam l'chavero, and that is what we talk about, the morality and the stories that we're going to look at. We are going to look at almost exclusively stories of bein adam l'chavero rather than the stories of bein adam l'makom. And so he doesn't hear, he doesn't take that same approach that we saw in the other Mefarshim, but he does build up for us in a very strong way the idea that our forefathers have to be a role model. And a role model specifically of justice, righteousness, caring for others, that idea as well. And I really feel that in Judaism, if you had to sort of define Judaism, is really a religion that talks about growth, which talks about learning, which talks about being constantly, halakha even means to go forward. And that is our goal, and that will be our goal here. And that I don't think it really matters whether we view the Avot as totally evil or view the Avot as totally positive. Our goal here is going to be use them as a tool for growth, as a tool for learning, and that yes, if they did sin, they overcame it. If we stumble, we too can overcome it, and we're going to try to, with humility, to approach these stories and learn from them.
So you could never take this class in language.
I could never. Well, this, no, I know. No, I think. No, not only could I never give this class in Lakewood, I would never give this class in high school.
Why?
I would never do this in high school either. Because high school minds, teenage minds, are still in that black and white.
But they're not.
Depends. I guess it depends. Depends. But you have to be more.
Then exactly.